So tonight, we're going to, just an overview of what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to go over the next levels of a meditation practice, which involves six conditions for the environment. So I will review the six conditions for a proper meditation environment. After that, Melissa will talk, or I don't know, one of us will talk about, we'll actually start the object of our meditation for the next couple of weeks, and that's going to be the Lam Rim. So we're now introducing ourselves to a short version of the Lam Rim, and we'll read from the Lam Rim, and we'll match it against the outline, and I'll explain two verses, and I believe Melissa will explain one or two verses, and then Melissa will guide us in a guided meditation again. And then our homework then for the next week will be to do this Lam Rim as the object of our meditation. And one of the other elements that Melissa is going to talk about is the eight elements that make up the proper posture for meditation. How to sit. How to hold your body, basically, in meditation. Mainly so that it's not distracted. Okay, so let's start with the six conditions of the environment. I want to say that these come from all of this comes from a Lam Rim, or that is actually kind of preliminary to a Lam Rim. Some of these meditation practices come from ancient Indian texts. Some of the things we're going to talk about, like in our conditions for a proper environment, you would say, oh, that's crazy, we don't have that problem today. But believe me, 1,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, these problems existed. So these are from that text, and I think it's important to adapt it to our current world. So we're going to do some kind of modern mapping to these old problems they had. The first one is to stay in a, or find a conducive place to do your meditation. Makes sense, right? So what does it mean to be in a conducive place? And in our famous tradition of lists, we have five subsets to a conducive place. Just so you don't forget. It's interesting. The first one is a nice one, things that we got covered out, right? It's called finding a place where things are easy to find. Okay? Things like what? Like food. Like shelter. Like medicine, help, both, you know, help with your meditation practice, so from someone who knows meditation well, help in all forms. So things that you need, water, you know, things that you'll need to live will be, are easy to find. Once again, remember that, come on in if you want, when we talk about meditations in these ancient Indian texts are talking about meditation, they're not talking about 15 minutes a day. Okay, they're talking about meditation as a lifestyle, as a practice. And they will go on long retreats of 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. So when they talk about a conducive place, they're not talking about a conducive place for 15 minutes. They're talking about a conducive place to live, all right? So it's important over time, if you're on a long retreat, to find a place that's close to water, that has access to food, and shelter and some of those other things. So keep that in mind. The second element of a conducive place, it should be a good place, in that it should be away from animals and not a fearful place. So a lot of people think it's really romantic to go out into a cave or go into the forest and meditate. We're not really built for that in our American Manhattan lifestyle, right? Bugs, ants. I mean, people, we freak out over bugs as big, you know. And we're 6 feet tall. It's crazy, right? But we do, right? Imagine trying to settle your mind and get into a state of quietude, mental quietude, and physical quietude, and you've got, like, a spider crawling across your hand. A harmless spider, right? But they're crawling across your hand. And you just freak out. You jump. Like, you just can't meditate out there. You know, in other parts of the world, there are dangerous things. There are snakes and bears and lions and stuff. So you have to have a place where when you close your eyes for an hour, you're not worried about being attacked. Okay?
Well, and this also, you know, 10 or 15 years ago in New York City, it might have depended the neighborhood that you live in too, you know? Like, we're very, very fortunate. Not only do we live in this, you know, relatively safe country and city. But there's countries and cities where you might not feel so safe if you're sitting and meditating. Like, maybe you won't think somebody is going to break into your house while you're sitting for that 15 minutes, but it might be in the back of your mind. Like, maybe, you know, we have a friend who lives in Colombia, and she lives in the country, and they have a guard that, like, lives with them 24 hours a day, you know, just to watch their house. And so we're very fortunate that we don't have to worry about this one too much because, you know, we kind of have it covered.
We'll touch on that a little bit later about how we have a life of leisure and fortune, right, for that safety alone. That was good. So the third element of a conducive place is to be in an environment that doesn't cause sickness. And it's we take it for granted that we live in relative health. We've got drinking water out of the tap. We've got healthy food anywhere we want it. We don't get sick easily. You go to parts of the world, you cannot drink the water. You cannot eat the food without boiling it to death. And it's really an issue, right? Our biggest problems in the city are probably chemical things, like get a new carpet, you know, and have a headache for 2 weeks. And it's because it's all evaporating these chemicals, right? So it's, these types of things are, you know, are dangerous to your environment. So, so being a place that doesn't cause sickness. Fourth one is to be in a place where there's good friends. Good friends means that they are actually, well, good means that they're not inhibiting your practice. They share a certain worldview, and that at least they're not inhibiting, and hopefully they're helping it in some ways. Like, if you have a roommate or a friend who's like, you know, come on, let's go out, let's do this or this, let's go, and, you know, we'll drink all night, we'll watch the World Cup, and you're trying to get up in the morning at 7 o'clock to meditate, the two are incompatible, right? Or you're trying to meditate in the morning, your roommate wants to listen to, you know, music while they get dressed and stuff, and you want to sit there and meditate. It's hard, right? It's really hard. There's a real synergy of your practice with other people who are practicing, because it just you just ride that wave. So you want to be with people who at least don't inhibit your practice. And the last conducive place, basically, it shouldn't be too busy. As we live in Manhattan, not too many people during the day or during the night. Once again, it's about distractions and trying to get mental quietude because humans are distracting, voices are distracting, voices are kind of create an analytical response in our brains rather than like birds or abstract noises like cars or something. So that's a breakdown of the conducive environment. So the second conditions for the environment is to, now we're kind of going into lifestyle things rather than the place, and that is to live simply with few needs, which really kind of means not have too many attachments to things. And once again, it's about the state of the mind when it has these strong desire attachments to things, like the new iPhone's coming out. How many people ordered it today? Nobody? No, we're ready. We're not willing to. 600,000 people ordered it today, and you weren't any of them. But if you were planning on that this morning and going to meditate, you'd be like, got to get to the Apple Store, got to call AT&T, I got to get in line. You know, there's this attachment to things that take your mind away from trying to focus on the object. Okay, so in general, that's an example, but have your wants few, as they say. The third one goes along with that, and it says, be satisfied with what you have. There's a real peace that you gain when you have satisfaction in your life. Satisfaction in your job, your apartment, your relationships, your family, yourself, you know, who you are, what you look like, what you sound like. There's a real, like, you know, relaxing, satisfying nature when you actually come to peace with all these things. So, be satisfied with what you have. Don't try to change anything. It creates this disturbance of unaccepting of what you've already got, right? And you want something which you don't have, and you're just craving. It's a form of craving, of desire. There's also coming to an understanding that the more you have doesn't make you any happier, okay? And speaking of material things, I could upgrade an iPhone, and it's not going to, I think it's going to make me happy, right? And it's going to satisfy me for about 30 minutes, and then the happiness will go away, right? And if you watch how we are attached to these things, pursue them, get them, thinking they're going to give us happiness, but is that happiness last? No, nothing lasts, right? That happiness will fade off just like everything else, right? As you understand that, you're like, I'm okay with what I've got. I'm not going to go chasing this thing for happiness, which doesn't create happiness. Fourth element is to, a very Sanskrit word here, get unbusy, which means to not be too busy in your life. This would certainly be the case for if you're going to do long retreats. You definitely want to unbusy yourself and detach yourself from a busy schedule and a busy life. Whether it's a weekend or a month retreat or longer, you need to unbusy yourself. On a daily practice of 15 minutes a day, what we're asking is to fit that into your already busy life. Because I know everyone's got a busy life. We're all living in the same world here. But ultimately, I sit down sometimes and try to meditate and I plan my day out. You know, I sit first thing in the morning and I'm just like, okay, what am I going to do this? What am I going to make for lunch? What am I going to do this? Right? And it's because I've got a busy lifestyle. If I unbusied myself, my mind would be much more at peace in the morning. And when I do retreats and I don't have that busy schedule, I don't have to be somewhere at 1, I don't have to be somewhere at 4, then it's much easier. It's much easier. The fifth of the sixth is to live an ethical or clean life. And we touched on this last week in that, you know, if you just woke up in bed with your wife's, with your best friend's wife, for example, right? You can't just go down and sit down and meditate, right? Your mind is just like all these things, right? It just doesn't work. And it's, you know, if you just killed somebody, you're just not going to go and say, okay, I'm going to go meditate. You know, it just doesn't work, right? You could say that they're kind of mutually exclusive and no one who just killed someone would try to meditate. But the point is your mind is so disturbed by those activities, deep down, that you'll never get the stillness in your mind to be able to focus and do any kind of meditation. In a larger sense, those activities do not create the results for a proper practice, right? They create obstacles to practice, right? And if you want to remove your obstacles to practice, like having a discipline or a place to meditate or a roommate that is conducive to your practice, the more you keep an ethical code of conduct, the more that your conditions will ripen around you to be able to support a meditative practice.
Okay. And I think this point is really important, that it's not just the big things, like killing somebody or sleeping with somebody else's wife. Like, it's the small things that we do every day, because those are the ones that add up. It's the habits that we do without thinking that, you know, in a very minor way is harming someone else. You know, it's the very subtle levels of taking life that we do over and over again every single day that really affect your ability to meditate. And hopefully we will have time in this class at some point to talk about that in a little more detail about why that's the case. But I think even more importantly than us trying to explain, like, why is that the case, is to experiment with this one yourself. Because meditation, being able to sit and meditate, being able to find the time to sit and meditate, being able to find the space to sit and meditate, it's really a result. You know, your ability to have the time in your life, your ability to have a concentrated mind is the result of keeping these ethics. And, you know, maybe experiment with it for like 6 months. Like, maybe choose something, maybe some small habit that you have, and watch it really closely for like 6 months and see if that doesn't have an effect on your meditation practice. And then, you know, if you're not convinced, maybe go the other way, you know, for a couple weeks and see how drastically it changes. But experiment with it, yourself to see if maybe there's a little truth in that.
Yeah, Geshe Michael would always have a good story. He said, people would come up to him and say, I've been doing my preliminaries, I've been doing my practice every day, I've got this great visualization, I've got Lama devotion, I really feel it in my heart, but my meditation's not going anywhere. And he'd look at them and he says, well, are you keeping your book? Which is another way of saying, are you watching your code of conduct and how you live your life? And they'd be like, well, you know, I didn't really get into that, and it's the foundation for successful practice. So it comes from a lot of areas. So we have the last one to do. The six of the conditions for your meditation environment is to get rid of worldly desires. So here, the key is a bit like living simply, removing some of your desire realm attachments. Because of that nature of craving, and there's a bigger picture here in that when they say worldly desires, we're kind of talking about cravings for food, cravings, another common craving is craving for affection or sex, they call it, craving for being well known. You know, there are certain innate cravings in our desire realm. As beings in the desire realm, we have these kind of innate cravings for things. And they're called worldly desires, success, material things. They're large scope items. And this one is to try to live a lifestyle in which those aren't your goals. Okay? Because they are not real milestones on your spiritual path. You could have the most amount of money. You could have the best looks. You could have as much technology, you could have as much sex as you want, and you end up dying just like everybody else. You know, getting old, getting sick, and dying. And you haven't changed anything. Just because you've got money, or because you look great, or anything else. Okay, those do not change your life. Okay, and it's over time there will be a deep understanding of these types of things. But that's what it means here. Okay, the sixth one is get rid of worldly desires. And most of these are lifestyle changes. And if you were serious about something, you would undertake a lifestyle change. For example, when I went to college or even went back out of the working world into grad school, my lifestyle changed. Why? Because I went to school, right? And school is a change of a lifestyle. And then you say, well, I'm really serious about yoga. I want to be a yogi. I want to take this up. Your lifestyle changes. Especially when your teacher says, well, your class starts at 7:30 in the morning. You know, everything changes based on your priorities. Your lifestyle changes when you get a job. What if your best job, you know, what if you want to be a musician, right? Your job's at night for the most part. Your lifestyle changes. Your lifestyle changes when you have a baby, right? All of these things are lifestyle changes. If meditation and the goals of meditation are something which you desire and which you crave and you're serious about, these types of things will institute a bit of a lifestyle change. But it can all be done right here in Manhattan. Right? You don't have to go out in the middle of the desert to start your practice. I know people who do retreats here in the middle of Manhattan. It's perfectly fine. Loads of ways to make all that work. So with what you've got now, keeping your current world, you can change it and affect small changes in your lifestyle to have a conducive meditation practice. Any questions on the six conditions?
I was just wondering about being satisfied with what you have.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it one of the results of meditation, of having this balance?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of difficult to have it first.
Which comes first, yeah. Well, quite often they say that a lot of these things feed into each other, and you get on what's called an upward spiral. One feeds in the other. It helps to get more of that, more of that, more of that, and it just eventually it becomes very natural. Like, you won't have the obstacles to meditate in the morning because you get the benefits of it, which is wanting to do it, and then you just, that obstacle goes away. In the beginning, it's sometimes brute force. I'm like, you just do it.
It's true. My meditation teacher says that, usually the best meditators are the stubborn ones. you know, because you have to be stubborn for a while before things start getting into alignment. So
then you kind of get on that path where things start to feed into it. So we didn't say it'd be easy. I don't think anyone's Skyping in, so I'm just going to close.
So the object of our meditation, like I mentioned earlier, is going to be the Lam Rim, which means steps on the path to enlightenment.
Can you spell that?
Lam is L-A-M, and Rim is R-I-M.
Just like
it sounds. And so the Lam Rim is a type of text. There's short Lam Rims, like the one that we'll go through, that's more like a prayer. And then there's longer Lam Rims, you know, 100 pages. There's middling length ones that are like 1,000 pages. And then, you know, the largest ones, the what they call the Lam Rim Chenmo, Chenmo meaning really, really big, which are thousands of pages. So the one that we're going to talk about tonight is basically expanded upon in each of those larger sizes of Lam Rims. So the first Lam Rim was requested by the Tibetans. There was a teacher from India that, you know, Buddhism started in India and it moved into Tibet. And for a while, you know, there were teachers going up to Tibet to bring Buddhism there. And, you know, Buddhism kind of had its rises and its falls in Tibet while they had their connection with India. And at one point, that was not necessarily a high point of Buddhism in India, or in Tibet. The Tibetans asked this great teacher, Atisha, for some help. And so he ended up composing the first Lam Rim, which was basically all of Buddhism. Like I said, very concisely organized in a very user-friendly way. It's basically, you know, they take you through and they say, you need to do this, and then next you do this, and next you do this, next you do this. It's like a roadmap of exactly how to get to our end goal. So everything you need to know is in there, and it also serves as a map where you can look and you can kind of see where you are along the path, what you might need next, what some obstacles you might come into next will be. So this Lam Rim is called The Source of All My Good, and it's by Jason Kappa. So J is J-E, and Tsongkhapa is T-S-O-N-G-K-A-P-A. And in our lineage, the Gelug lineage, the lineage of the Dalai Lama, Jason Kappa is the founder of that lineage. So you'll hear his name a lot if you can continue studying this in this lineage. So do you want to read like a little bit first and
sure.
Talk about it?
Yeah. So it's fascinating. Just as a reference, the reading material for this class that some of you are already having there printed, it's all in the appendices. So for those who are new to the class, we'll send you the PDF for the reading materials. And if you print out the appendices, there's the Lam Rim called The Source of All My Good. And it's amazing. It's 14 verses, and it's the entire Buddhist path. This is the cliff notes of the Lam Rim. And then there is an outline for the Lam Rim as well. And that outline makes cross-references back to these 14 verses. So you can see where you are in the Lam Rim based on this poetic version of the Lam Rim. So we have an outline version and a poetic version. So we should go fast. Time check. Okay, so I don't know. Does anyone have the reading?
No.
I'll read it out loud. Okay, so we're going to start with the... I'm going to do the first two verses. So I'll read the first one here. It's called, "The Source of All My Good." The source of all my good is my kind Lama, my Lord. Bless me first to see that taking myself to them in the proper way is the very root of the path, and grant me then to serve and follow them with all my strength and reverence. So this first verse of the Lamrim introduces the foundation, and it talks about the Lama, okay, as the root of the path, the source of all my good, right? All my good means basically all that I need to know and to do in order to reach the goals of this path, which is total enlightenment, reside within the knowledge and wisdom and the path lined out for you by your Lama. Okay, this is a fundamental step in the Lamrim, in all of these teachings, so fundamental it starts the whole thing out. It doesn't even preamble with anything else. It just starts out with, "Source of all my good is my kind Lama, my Lord," you know. And that's how they're referencing their Lama as their Lord here. We will not go into a lot of the Lama teachings. It's sometimes called Lamaism and Lamaist ideology in this class, because it would take us a lot of time. There's a lot of material on it, and we'd love to teach that, but it's not. Right now we're just going to cover how to take a Lama, what are the certain high-level qualities of a Lama, and how you should act towards your Lama, okay? But understand that this foundation or this doorway is fundamental to eventually you're achieving your goals. And they make that very clear here by making it the very first verse. So the first steps of the Lamrim then say that you must have faith and reverence in your Lama, okay? So you can have... faith and reverence for them in two ways. So let's talk about faith in your Lama. It's basically how to serve them in your thoughts and in your actions. So body and mind, okay? And speech is a form of a body in this case, so they don't separate it out. So one way is you can serve your body, your Lama, in terms of, or have faith in your Lama in terms of thoughts, right? Is really how you should see your Lama. It's hard to go into without putting out a lot of detail of how you should approach your Lama, but through a series of logical analysis, through analytical meditations, through reading certain scriptures, I'm just going to cut to the punchline here, and that is, eventually you must see your Lama as an emanation of an enlightened being. Okay, you must not start that way, but you must eventually get to that point in your practice. You will start with seeing your Lama in different ways, as a person who can, they've got some qualities that I would like. Oh, wow, they've got some things that I really like to learn. Wow, they've had realizations I'd like to have. Wow, they know how to get those realizations. I want to learn how to have those realizations too. All the way up to, this person has seen emptiness directly. I want to see emptiness directly. Or this person is a totally enlightened being. I want to be a totally enlightened being. It's a gradual step of your relationship with your teacher that you'll get to. But right now, in ways of serving them or having faith in them in terms of your thoughts, just think of them as a very high enlightened being, as a being who can assist you in getting to your goal of total enlightenment. Then in the form of actions, the highest way to really serve your Lama is to complete what they ask you to do, okay? Whether it's to teach, whether it's to follow their advices, to honor them, to serve them, are all ways of having faith in your Lama through your actions, through your body. There's quite a bit of literature and scripture as well, and what are the qualities of a Lama? And we're not going to go into all of those right now, but there are three high-level things that I just want to talk about in terms of what the Lama should have. They should occupy themselves primarily with the Dharma versus material things. They should be more concerned with the future life than the present life. And that's a notion of, they've got an understanding of causality and understanding that their actions now will impact their future life. And we'll talk about that more at another time, maybe. And they should be altruistic, more concerned with helping others than helping themselves. Okay. So when it says they're the root of the path, it's really that they're the medicine for your suffering, is a metaphor. They're the medicine to help you get out. They are the doctor for your pain, right? They're the doctor for teaching you and getting you the medicine to change your world into something totally blissful and paradisical, if there is such a word. Okay, the second verse in the long run talks about leisure and fortune. So have that in mind. Bless me first to realize that the excellent life of leisure I've found just this once is ever so hard to find and ever so valuable. Grant me then to wish and never stop to wish that I could take its essence night and day. So this covers an area of the Lamrim called, it's really designed to create an appreciation of your leisure and fortune, which means you've got it good, right? We've all got it good here in this world. There's quite a few breakdowns in this material. There's three primary ones. There's one, recognize right now our fortune to be, okay, within the human realm, right? We all know this world, Earth. We were all born mostly in America. Well, we're all living in America now, right? We're all living in New York. We could be somewhere else, right? We could have been born anywhere else in the world, and we wouldn't have any of the opportunities that we would have had over the last, in our lifetimes. We were born in a place where ends up being the world superpower during our lifetime, right? What are the chances of that? We're in the richest country on Earth, right? The opportunities you have here in America are profoundly different than anywhere else in the world, okay? Put on top of that New York City. And New York City is like a god realm compared to so many places in the world. And you are living here, right? We've all got this opportunity here. Most of us have an education, right, of some form or another, whether it's high school, college, post-grad, all sorts of things. Things that put us into a very, very small percentile of the overall population of this planet. What we've got in our waking day, and as we walk around our world and live in a place like we do, we're not at war in our own country. You know, we have freedom of expression, freedom of speech, we've got safety. We go to the store, we've got every bit of fruit and from anywhere in the world at any time of the year. It's absurd, the luxuries that we have here. Our fortune as a human to be born now in this time. We have to have some kind of realization of that fortune, right? Secondly, what is the purpose of this now? Okay, if you get some understanding of like, wow, you're right, you know, I've been to India and I've, you know, I saw how they treated people in different castes, and here I am born in this world. What does it mean that I'm born in this world like this now? What is the purpose of this fortuitous life? Is it to get as many things as you can before you die and then die? You know? Is that really what you're here for? Or is there something much more profound that can be attained out of your fortuitous rebirth here right now? Okay. And we'll talk about what that is. Basically, that is the goal of our path, right? To realize our life right now to a point where we become, you know, enlightened beings, you know, as depicted in these tantra, right? And you can do it. And we have that opportunity that people, you know, elsewhere in the world don't have, right? You could go further and say, what about animals? You could, if you believe that potentially, if you have this understanding of future lives and past lives, what if you were born as an animal? You have no possibility of reaching the state of Avalokiteshvara here as an animal, right? There are great analytical meditations on leisure and fortune which just leave you with this sense like, well, I'm a diamond in the rough. I'm as rare as this diamond in this piece of coal. The third element of leisure and fortune is how hard it is to if this were to end, how hard it would be to get back here, Okay, you have to understand the uniqueness of this possibility. Does anyone know the causes for their being in this God realm right now on this earth called Manhattan? You know, and being exposed to Dharma and having the life of leisure and fortune and the leisure time to come to a class on a Wednesday night instead of working or cooking or doing all these other things. How did you get here? Yes. Right, but what were those seeds? Yes, well, you planted virtue, obviously. And usually you know your past by looking at your present, right? So you must have taught other people in the past to be a student of worldview now. Okay, think about that. How else are you going to get the seeds in a world of causality to have a result of being taught unless you taught? Okay, that's a larger topic, but ultimately, and totally enlightened beings have the omniscience to know exactly what those deeds were to get you here. But if, and I don't know how I got here, right, for all of my previous lives, or even in this life, what caused me to be here in this room. In other words, I couldn't recreate this experience if I tried. Right? How would I get back here in this incredible, how could I cause a rebirth in this incredible place again and have this leisure and fortune again? There's a metaphor for it. And the metaphor we're going to touch on later, but I'll explain it now, and that is, it's about as rare as a blind turtle going up from the bottom of the sea and finding a golden noose on the top of the ocean. Once every million years or something. Some extravagant amount. And we're that blind turtle who found the golden noose on the in the top of the ocean in their first try out of millions of years. Okay? That's how rare this is. Very brief leisure and fortune. So that's the first and the second verses of the Source of All My Good. One is the importance of reliance on a lama, and second, understanding some notion of how special this life is right now and how rare an opportunity is.
So the next verse, my body and the life in it are fleeting as the bubbles in the sea froth of a wave. Bless me first thus to recall the death that will destroy me soon, and help me find sure knowledge that after I've died, the things I've done, the white or the black, and what these deeds will bring me, follow always close behind, as certain as my shadow. So this part of the Lam Rim, basically the two verses that Michael did are kind of the preliminaries. And this is called the steps shared with those of the lesser scope. So there are three scopes of practitioners in Buddhism, those of the lesser scope. And basically what defines those practitioners are they, everything they do in their present life is solely for the next life. Like, their entire goal of this life is to get a better rebirth, to get a higher rebirth, to get another human life. They are so aware of their death and the impermanence of this life at every moment. They're so aware of the fact that our life could come to end at any moment, that all they do is they strive to make their next life better. So, you know, they're not worried about getting the next newest iPad. You know, they don't care about, becoming famous or doing well necessarily in their career or... you know, they're not worried about what the person next to them is thinking about them. Like, their entire reason for being here, their entire reason for every action is to keep their morality so that they're assured a higher rebirth in their next life. And so how do you get to become one of these practitioners? Because, you know, you really can't call yourself a Buddhist until you're... every action of every day is for your next life, until you really believe in past and future lives and you're working to make your next life a human rebirth or higher, right? So we develop concern for the next life through death awareness meditation. And this has 3 points. The first point that we recall is that death is certain. That death is certain because we are born, we will die. You know, there's nobody here that can escape death. We all know this. It's obvious, but it's not something that I think most of us, you know, have a profound understanding of, or maybe we just don't think about it very often. The time of death is uncertain. So, you know, we're a little bit unfortunate. It's a little bit unfortunate in this culture. We don't see a lot of death. Like, the people who are older, the people who are getting sick are kind of secluded away from us. You know, we don't see a lot of that. And we have this notion of an average lifespan. So, you know, you're 30, you're 40, you're 50, you think you still have, you know, a good chunk of life left because the average lifespan is like 72 years or something like that, right? But really, you know, death can come at any moment. There's no certainty when it will come. And then the last part of that death awareness meditation is that at the time of death, nothing can help you. The only thing that will be of any service to you is how you've developed your mind in this life. You know, your friends can't help you. All of the money in the world can't help you. You know, it's just what you've done to develop your mind. So, next they contemplate the suffering of the lower births. You know what Michael was talking about, if we look at the life we have and we think about the karmic correlations of what brought that life about, and then we look at our current life and see, you know, what kind of seeds we're planting. You know, if we're really lucky, it might be 50-50. Black seeds and white seeds that will give us a higher rebirth and seeds that will give us a lower rebirth. And, you know, the percentages don't even matter because it only takes one seed to ripen. So you could have 90% white karma or 99% white seeds that you've planted, but at the moment of death, maybe that one black one ripens, you know, and you're thrown into the lower realms. So that's another step that we'll contemplate. And so developing a fear that this is a possibility, that this could actually happen, once we have that fear, and in this case fear is good because fear is going to be our motivation to practice. Fear is going to be our motivation for finding something in this life that can that can help us, something that can truly protect us from this suffering. And you're not able to go for refuge. You know, this refuge that we practice in the preliminaries of our meditation is just that, it's a practice. It's not until we have this fear of, you know, this very real fear of our next rebirth, of some kind of suffering, that we can really go for refuge. You know, and what do you go for refuge in? We'll talk about it a bit in the meditation, but basically it's in the good deeds that we've done in this life. Because they have to ripen, and they will ripen. And that's, you know, the only certainty, the only refuge that we can take. And then finally, because of this, we contemplate the laws of karma. We maximize our good deeds, and we minimize the bad deeds. So, anybody have any questions on the Lam Rim as we've presented it so far?
Oh, we're going very fast. As you can imagine, there's a huge amount of detail underneath these. And we can give you some reference material for other books that will drill down a lot more. Quite often here, you go to a teaching, and the teacher will teach on just one of these for 2 or 3 hours. So
maybe one thing. I maybe don't understand the difference between desire for wanting an iPhone or the desire for wanting another life. They seem kind of the same to me.
Yeah. Some people say, like, well, shouldn't I have some desire to get out of suffering? Shouldn't I have some desire to have a higher rebirth? Or shouldn't I have a desire to meet a teacher? Shouldn't I have a desire to reach nirvana, these things? Desire in itself is neutral, right? It's it can be used for good, bad, or nothing, right? An iPhone would probably be kind of neutral. It just costs you a little bit of money, and then that's that. But the thing is, it doesn't do anything for you either. If anything, it perpetuates a bit of ignorance, thinking that an iPhone will make you happy. You could buy 100 iPhones with the wisdom that it will not make you happy, and understanding its true nature as and what type of object it is, and it's fine, right? It's part of it is your view of the object and what your desire is and how you're desiring it.
Yeah, it was less about the iPhone, more about the next life thing.
Uh-huh.
It was more about why should I, because I don't particularly believe right now that
right.
I'll have an afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering why I should.
Why you should think about it. Right.
Why I should desire it, because mostly I came here to still my mind in the
right.
present, and that was all I had in mind.
Yep. There's, as a parallel course, one of the things that's taught in the monasteries relatively early on is this notion, and our culture doesn't have this innately, but Asian cultures do, or Western culture, or Eastern cultures do, and that there is this notion culturally of, well, if I got here once, there's a good chance I would have gotten here another time, either in the past or in the future, right? If I had enough randomness to get here once, surely it can happen anytime, right? I could be potentially reborn. And there's a lot of logical understandings and analysis about past lives, present life, and future lives. And it's important here, in part what Melissa mentioned about fear, and that is fear of a rebirth in a lower realm. So there's, if you understand this possibility of rebirth, then you could have a rebirth in a lower realm, which basically is a hell realm, or in a higher realm, which is, you know, some form of a god realm. And on this scope, you want to avoid being reborn in a lower realm. But there's an innate understanding that you already believe, and there's an understanding that you could be reborn in any of the realms. Ultimately, you've got to come to an understanding that either you reach what you're trying to do in this lifetime, or what you're going to do in this lifetime will carry over into another lifetime.
Mm-hmm. I also think that, in this course, learning meditation definitely will, like we said last week, it definitely will give you some stability to your mind, some peace and quiet to your mind. Like, you definitely can attain that through meditation. But I guess in this course, we just want to introduce the idea that, that's not the only thing that meditation can do. Like, the possibilities for meditation are, so much more than that. If that's all you want to get out of meditation, that's fine. But, this course is serving to explain, the vast array of possibilities that meditation can offer to you. Because a still and a calm mind is really great if there's only one life. Most of the time when I sit down and meditate, it's because that's what I want, I have the tiniest fraction of a doubt that there's nothing more to this life than this life. Like, it's so small, it's that curiosity that keeps me coming to these classes. It's so small that sometimes when I wake up in the middle of the night, I'm a little bit afraid of the dark because I think I might die, and I think there's a possibility that there could be something worse than this life. So, you know, if you have the slightest fraction of that doubt, that we could lose, you know, the fortunate situation that we have here, meditation can help with that. Otherwise it will just give a calm and peaceful mind. Whatever you want, but there's so much for you to choose from. You can use the tool for whatever goal. So.
Yeah.
Why are animals considered lower realms? I mean, why are we judging other animals having not the same kind of consciousness, or
they
could still be happy?
When this is an animal lover, she'll tell you.
I agree. You know, we can tell you what scripture says. We can tell you what the Buddhist scripture says. I'm not convinced yet. You know, I think Buddhist scripture says the reason that animals are at a disadvantage is because the majority of the animals that you look at are like, you know, constantly having to look out for predators, constantly having to run away from this or that. They constantly have a fear of death with them. There's also the animals that are under control of humans, you know, animals of, what do they call them, animals of burden,
mm-hmm.
you know, horses, oxen.
Cows, all the meat we eat, all the animal products we eat. They're all raised for one thing, and that's to serve us. Really, they're raised to be slaughtered for.
But yeah, I definitely have that question as to why we separate ourselves from animals. Because, you know, biologically speaking, we are animals. Like, what separates us? It's, you know, the fact they say it's because we have free will. It's because we have the ability to make choices and decisions. I don't know. I'm not convinced. You know, I have a cat, and we're very close. And I've done meditation in our apartment, meditation retreats in our apartment. And when I do that, like, we get closer on another level, you know? And in some ways, I think that, you know, some animals are maybe more advanced. In their ways of communicating, in their ways of thinking, in their spiritual development. Like, I definitely have that thought in my mind. So, you know, that's what all of the great saints and sages say. I don't know if they're just saying that because that helps us now, or if that's truly the case, but I don't know.
I've been coming to a lot of different classes here,
mm-hmm.
and I think this is the third time that somebody's sitting right over there.
It's the wall. That's
so
great.
That's funny.
That's probably true. Yeah, there's a lot to be said about that. Why don't we take a quick leg stretch, and then we'll get into our meditation, and that's the meditation which we can work on for the next week. Or you can ask any questions and other people can, you know, can leave if they want.
First point of the posture is your legs. And they say you should be in full lotus, which, you know, is when one foot is up here and one foot is up here. Which is another reason why yoga is helpful. I can't do it. You can do half lotus, which is where you take one of your heels and you put it up here. I can't demonstrate that either. Or you can have no lotus, which is just basically a comfortable cross-legged posture. Or if that's bothersome, you can also sit, you know, on your heels or putting a yoga block like between your legs, and you can sit like this. Sometimes it's nice. Also, if the ground is just not working for you, you know, if you've been meditating a lot or you have some pain or, you know, eventually in our life we just might not be able to sit on the floor like this, a chair is fine as well. The second point of the 8-point posture is your eyes. And here again, you have a couple of options. The traditional suggestion is to have your eyes halfway open and halfway closed and staring down the length of your nose to a spot, you know, kind of out here, not in focus, but just, you know, a soft gaze. That's very difficult for me. It's a little bit distracting because it's so difficult. So then you can either do it with your eyes open. If you do it with your eyes open, you want to make sure that in your daily practice that you have something that's not like colorful or disturbing in front of you. This is good to have your eyes open if you tend to get a little drowsy in your meditation. It's good to have your eyes open. So maybe you just gaze down the length of your nose with a soft focus again, but your eyes can be all the way open. Or you can close your eyes, which is what I like to do because I tend to get more distracted than anything else. So closing your eyes helps to cut off that distraction, and it's very helpful in visualization meditations and can make your images clearer. The most important part of this posture is to keep your back straight. You know, don't be leaning too far back or far forward. You don't want to be hunched and rounded over or too far like upright. If you're hunched, you're going to notice that you have the tendency to get a little bit drowsy. Your mind will get dull as you're meditating. You know, if you're sitting up way too straight, you could tend to get more agitated and distracted. So you want to find a place right in the center where the spine kind of supports itself, and you want to have the natural curve in your lower back and the natural curve in your neck. Your shoulders should be straight. You might have to look in the mirror or have somebody help you with this, because sometimes, you know, just from life we have the tendency to have one higher than the other. But it's important to make that even. Your head should just be balanced on the top of your spine. Don't be looking too far up or too far down, because then again, you know, you'll get a little bit sleepy if you're too far down, and you'll get a little bit agitated if you're too far up. So your chin should be parallel to the ground. Your teeth and lips should be in a natural, neutral position. The tendency is to clench your jaw when you're meditating. So, you know, loosen your lips. They say at Shambhala to just like, you know, not quite keep them touching. Just the slightest bit apart, and that helps to relax your jaw. But then again, it should be comfortable, you know, so don't strain. Your tongue will just sit in its natural resting position. And then your breath. You want to have a nice, even, smooth breath. You don't have to focus on it too much, because it will just smooth out on its own, especially as we begin with our watching cycle of about 10 breaths. So take your meditation posture. Get comfortable. We're going to try not to move for the preliminaries today. It may be a little bit hard and you may have some sensations, but try to keep still just for this first 5 or 7 minutes, and then I'll give you a little fidget break while we're still in the meditation. So get comfortable. maintain the 8-point posture. And begin by watching your breath. Watch it as it goes out and as it comes in. Just get really interested in your breath, the temperature as it changes, warm coming in and cooler coming out. Go for refuge tonight. We will go to refuge in our meditation, the belief that a regular practice in meditation can give us something that we desire, something that we don't have now. Generate bodhicitta by thinking about how many suffering beings there are in our world, how many humans out there are in a much worse off situation than we are, how they are truly and obviously suffering. Maybe they don't have enough food. Maybe their home has been destroyed by war or a natural disaster. Think about those people who work every waking moment of the day just to scrape together a bit of money for a bit of food. And then think about the fortune that we've been born into and how we can use this fortune to help them. Invite a teacher in front of you. Invite a being that has a quality or some knowledge that you would like to learn. Think of one or two of their good qualities and rejoice in them. Think how great it is that you've found someone with these qualities, someone who is willing to teach them to you. Make offerings to them. Because their teachings are so precious, because they have qualities that we would really like to have ourselves, give them something that reflects how much you want this knowledge, that reflects how much you would really like to develop that quality in yourself. You know, because this quality is priceless, maybe we want to give them something like our efforts. We can offer them our efforts that we've made this past week in our meditation. Then confess something that you've done in the past 24 hours that may negatively affect your meditation practice here tonight. Recall the event. Briefly replay it in your mind. And think how that was just not the right thing to do, how how foolish it was, and resolve not to do it again, because you know that it will affect your meditation practice. And then know that by confessing this deed in front of your teacher, it's gone. Believe it. You've cleaned it. Rejoice in something good you've done today. You made it to class today. Rejoice in the good deeds of all those around you. Maybe you heard a nice news story today about something good someone did for someone else, and rejoice in this. Then beg this teacher in front of you to stay near you. Beg them not to die before they've taught you what you want to learn. And because their teaching that they could give you is so important, beg them to teach you. They say it's auspicious if you beg them three times, so see yourself three times begging them to teach you, begging them to teach you, begging them to teach you. Now, in your meditation posture with your eyes in the same place, you can take a small fidget break if you need to stretch a leg or twist a little. You can do so. And then we'll go back to watching the breath. Now imagine yourself in a dark forest. It's thick and dense. It's difficult to find your way through. You're struggling and frustrated. This represents life without a spiritual practice. This represents life without a foundation in ethics and morality. Then, spontaneously within this dark forest, you see a path and you follow it to a clearing. You are on the shore of an island, and across you look and you see another island in the distance, and on that island you see your teacher. The teacher gets into a boat and rows himself over to your shore. He gets out of the boat and takes your hand and helps you over to the boat. He puts you in the front seat so you don't have to row, and he pushes you back into the water. As he rows you across the water, on your way over to his island or her island, you see a sea turtle bobbing above the surface of the water with a gold ring around his neck. This symbolizes the leisure and fortune of the life that we are living. So when you are on your own and meditating at this point, you can bring to mind all the leisure and fortune that you've been blessed with in this life. The teacher continues to row, and he rows the boat ashore on the island. He helps you out of the boat, and you look up and you see that there are stairs leading to a huge palace. These stairs represent the Lam Rim, the steps on the path to enlightenment. Your teacher takes your hand and he guides you up the stairs. Throughout this meditation, your teacher will either be holding your hand or standing right next to you, because they are your guide along these steps. They are there only to help you. So you get to the top of the stairs and you reach a yellow door. This yellow door represents the steps shared with those of the lesser scope. So remember in your meditation what defines a practitioner of the lesser scope. You walk in to a triangle room. You are at the apex of the triangle and the room opens up wide as you walk in. And directly in front of you, the first thing you see as you walk in is a glass coffin. And you look inside and you see your body, your corpse there. This step in the meditation is where we reflect upon our death awareness. The three facts: that death is certain, that the time of death is uncertain, and at the time of death, only the Dharma, only your practice of morality and ethics can help you. So, because of these three facts, because death is certain, resolve to make your practice of meditation, your practice of ethics, a priority in your life. Because the time of death is uncertain, make it an urgent priority. And because only your practice, only your keeping of your ethics can help you at the time of death, decide that you will minimize the meaningless activities in your life and only practice those things which are worthwhile. To the left of the coffin, you see a pile of cockroaches and big hairy spiders, scorpions. These bugs represent your bad deeds, which will follow you when you die. At this point of the meditation, you can reflect about the type of rebirth that your bad deeds will cause. So, because of this, we will purify these bad deeds, grab up a handful of the bugs, and walk to the top left corner of the room. And in the top left corner is a blazing fire. Throw these bugs into the fire. And as you watch them burn, as you hear the snap, crackle, and pop, review the four forces of purification, which are bringing up refuge and bodhicitta. Regretting the negative action you did because you know that it will harm you in the future. Resolve not to repeat the action again. And come up with an antidote to that negative deed. It's most helpful if you think of a particular action as you are throwing the bugs into the fire. Something very specific that you can purify. So walk back to the coffin and look to the right and see a pile of gems, of precious stones. These represent all the good deeds you've done in your life. Gather an armful of them and walk up to the top right corner of the room. At the top right corner, there is a chair upon which a robe of precious fabric is laid across. Put these jewels onto the robe so that it becomes a bejeweled robe and put it on your shoulders. This represents your going for refuge, the fact that your good deeds cannot be lost is your refuge. Because of this, resolve to put more jewels on your robe to do more good deeds. Because we may have more than just this life, because we can't be certain, resolve to put more jewels on this robe, maximize your good deeds, and minimize the negative deeds which harm yourself and harm others. At this point of the meditation, contemplate the laws of karma and decide if you really believe them. Is it really true that every cause has an effect? Is it really true that an effect must have a cause similar in nature? Is it really true that an effect will be much larger than the cause? Resolve to use this life of leisure and fortune that you have. Resolve to make the most of it. So reinvigorate that image of your teacher and invite them to come and sit inside your heart center. So watch them as they grow smaller. Come to the tip of your head and turn to face the same direction as you. See if you can feel them like melting butter, melting into the tip of your head, and feel them as they go down following your backbone until they reach your level of your heart. So see the merit from this meditation as white light beginning at your teacher's heart center. See this white light expand and fill his body. Feel this white light growing in your heart center and see if you can feel it spread to the rest of your body. And then feel it explode from the surface of your skin in all directions. See it hitting all the beings in this room and hitting all the beings in this world, those who are not as fortunate as we are, those who are struggling for food, those who are living without shelter, without safety. See as this light touches them, they instantly become happy. They thank you. They thank you for using your leisure and fortune for what it's meant for. They thank you for learning meditation and for sending you their merit. return to your breath and come back to the